compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
I'll never outlive that, will I? 888. What was that now? I'll never outlive that. 888-914-9149. That number is sponsored by Catholic Order of Foresters. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Doug in Bay Minette, Alabama. Hope I'm saying the name right.
Hey, absolutely. Perfectly.
All right.
So, Patrick, I didn't catch the man's name that called about truck driving, and I'm a retired truck driver. Okay. I did it for almost 14 years and almost 2 million miles safely. I had the same problem as well. I wanted to get to Mass, and so I just, you know, did all I could. Now, the laws have changed, the log books, all that. I don't know which company. They're more stringent with certain companies. But I used to just drop my trailer. I would park Saturday night, find a church locally, and then drop my trailer and bobtail to work. To Mass. And in at least 10 years, I probably didn't miss Mass more than five times during that time. And I just knew that if I put out the effort as much as I could, God will bless it. You know, you can't outgive God. So I put all my effort into it. I was always able to get to Mass. Now, it was different during the week if we had a holy day of obligation. I generally miss those. Maybe one time I was able to make one. But and then sometimes you can pull into a church. If you look at the map, zoom in. But it's a hard life. And I, when I started in 08, right in that bad recession, and I was hauling food and people still needed to eat, I went from $58,000 in credit card debt to zero in 2.5 years.
Excellent.
Just by living in the truck and all that. Now, I'm a single man, but he's a married man. What was his name again? I'd like to keep him in my prayers.
Yeah, I don't remember, but that's not important. Oh, Roberto, sure. I'm told. Yeah.
Roberto, okay. All right. Well, that's all I needed to say. Although California's a hard place to drive, and I got a speeding ticket out there in my last year over the road, and $490 for 15 over.
Wow.
I bought it, and yeah.
Did you win?
They think we have deep pocket. I did, because I fought it. It cost me $300 in lawyer's fees, but it was during COVID, and I said, look, I'm in my 60s and I'm hauling your milk and your orange juice and eggs and all that out here. I'm all over the country and New York, everywhere during COVID, and I'm risking my life. And this is how you're going to repay me? You know, this is the thanks I get. And so I wrote up a very nice affidavit and they threw it out. So okay. Praise God.
Well, yeah, that's a good thing. It's a novel defense. I had not heard of that before, but if they let you go with no fine, that's a good thing, seems to me. Well, I have to wonder, Doug, if you have the Relevant Radio app on your phone least when you were traveling.
I do.
That's got to be a great
locally. Sign. They started your show here probably a year or so ago on Archangel Radio.
Oh, yeah. Shout out to Archangel Radio down in is it Daphne that they're based in?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Shout out to all those great people down there.
Oh, yeah.
I actually I spoke at one of their fundraisers years ago. It's been quite a long time, but boy, did they feed me well when I was down there.
Yeah. Good food, that's for sure. Probably a little bit of, maybe you had some crab boil or crawdad.
It was I think there was a crawdad or two available. But well, thank you, Doug, for weighing in on the topic.
All right. God bless.
Good chatting. Bye bye. Thank you. Yeah. So, bottom line on this issue is, you have a Sunday obligation. You, as a Catholic, and your obligation has to do with if you are able to go to Mass. If you have a sick child at home. Let's say that your husband is on a business trip and you're home, mom, with a sickly child. You can't leave the child at home and the child needs you, well, you don't, your Sunday obligation is impossible to meet. You have a reason. If you are sick, if you are traveling, if a storm comes, a blizzard, or your car breaks down and you're, you know, 30 miles from the nearest church and you just can't physically get there, there could be many different reasons. Your obligation is not something that you have to worry about. It's if you intentionally, knowingly decide, well, I'm not going to go to Mass on Sunday, or a holy day of obligation. There's only four holy days of obligation the whole year. So that's when the Sunday obligation involves sin. If you just say, eh, no, I'm going to stay in bed, or I'm going to watch the game, or I'm going to do something other. In other words, what you're doing is you're not putting God first. And this is a requirement of the church. We have rights and privileges. We also have duties. And this is a joyful duty to gather together as a family, to go to Mass, to worship God in spirit and in truth, to receive Jesus in the Holy Eucharist. Don't think of it as you have to do it. Think of it as you get to do it. Not everybody thinks that way, but the main thing is that's when, if you miss Mass on purpose, that's when it's a serious sin. But if you're prevented from going to Mass for a legitimate reason, well, then there's no sin involved. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Rebecca in Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, Patrick. Thanks so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My husband is Lutheran, and he's a very faith-filled man. We have four young kids, and we raise our kids Catholic. That's what we agreed when we got married.
Congratulations, yeah.
Thank you. I pray that he comes into church one day, but he's also a very stubborn man. So my question is, he doesn't understand why the kids receive First Holy Communion in second grade. They don't receive it until eighth grade. And his thought behind it is, how can they understand at that age, why it is so important? You know, how can they conceptualize that?
Yeah.
So that's, I don't really know how to respond to him with that.
Okay. Well, I would propose a couple things that you could bring up. One would be that baptism, which of course is the initial sacrament, it completely regenerates the soul. So this is what we talk about in the Bible as the new birth, the bath, the washing of regeneration. So the soul is animated with the grace of God. And in the case of an infant who never had an opportunity to sin, there's no sin that's removed, but the condition of original sin is eradicated. And the soul is flooded with grace. Now, the child has no way of knowing any of these things when he's 2 or 3 weeks old, when you baptize an infant baby. He can't make a decision for God. He doesn't have the capacity to even know that God exists. He just knows that he's hungry right now, or he needs his diaper changed. That's all he knows. And so, yet, we still baptize infants because their understanding of what's going on is not necessary for the power of the grace to work in the soul of that child. And it's in an elevated sense that we consider baptism compared to, say, the Old Testament ordinance of circumcision. And there too, an 8-day-old boy had no conception about, well, what's that knife for? What are you going to do with that? And yet it was an enacting of the covenant between God and that male child, and it was a real and durable covenant, even though the child had no way of knowing what on earth any of that meant. All he knew is that it hurt. That's all. So baptism is at an elevated level, far higher than circumcision, because it's a sacrament and it conveys grace. It's the power of Christ working in the sacrament. So perhaps if you start there, you could point out that this august, important, all-important sacrament does not require the knowledge or even the consent of an infant who receives it because of the power of Jesus working the sacrament. So by extension, I would propose we can better understand the reason for receiving the Holy Eucharist when you're still young. 7 years of age is often considered the age of reason, and it's different for different people, but that's a good marker, a good base benchmark, I would say. It's interesting that Pope St. Pius X, who was the pope right around the turn of the 20th century, he lowered the age of receiving Holy Communion for children from about 15, which is where it had been for many centuries in the Latin Rite of the Church, down to 7. And it was a very revolutionary thing in a good way, But he said these children are old enough to at least know about Jesus, to at least know God exists and Jesus loves them and the Holy Eucharist is the bread of life, and they're old enough at that age to receive it. And that's true. I mean, think about all the people, Rebecca, who are adults and who still have at best a hazy understanding of the Holy Eucharist. So to have an understanding at a deep level is not necessary to benefit from the grace. And the other thing I'd like to pop in there, and then I'd be happy to hear what you think about this, is that in the Eastern churches of the Catholic Church, many of them anyway, and certainly the Orthodox churches in the Catholic Church, when a baby is baptized, he is also confirmed, they call it chrismated, and communed. So a two-week-old, a three-week-old is able to receive baptism, confirmation, and his first Holy Eucharist. And the custom of longstanding in those Eastern churches is that infants can come forward with their parents and babies in arms can receive Holy Communion. So that too is a kind of testimony, even though that's not the custom in the Latin Rite of the Catholic Church. You do see it elsewhere, and that's a further reminder that conscious awareness is good, but it's not necessary to receive the sacrament and enjoy the graces that come from it. So I'll stop there. Does that help a little bit?
It does. It does. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. Well, I didn't want to overburden you with too much of an answer, but I hope that's helpful when you have your conversation with your husband.
No, that's perfect. It's, you know, just need a fighting chance on it.
Okay, well, that's good. Well, I hope he'll start listening to the show if he doesn't already. And if he has any questions or wants to discuss anything, I'd be more than happy to talk to him.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Good chatting with you. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Diane now in Montclair, New Jersey. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, Patrick. I am registered at a local church in my diocese, but because of my schedule, I very often attend other churches within the same parish, within the same diocese, and sometimes even a church that's in a neighboring diocese. And because I'm not a wealthy woman, in fact, I'm quite tight on money, what I do is, when the collection comes around, I give to the church that I'm attending, figuring, you know, that's only fair. Mm-hmm. And I wanted your thoughts on that. And also, before I forget, mm-hmm. is there anywhere on your website that you have a list of books that you recommend on different topics?
Yes. So why don't we start there? We can knock that out quickly. So if you go to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick, and you'll see three buttons that say About, Links, and Contact. Click on Links. And if you click on my website, which is among the links, that will take you to where the books are.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Okay. All right. So now the first question, also easily answered, is, that's good. If you want to spread what you can donate by way of your weekly donation for your envelopes or something, you want to divide that, you know, give perhaps the lion's share to your parish where you're registered, but give something, if you can, to the other parishes that you attend. That's a good thing. And it helps them because, you know, they have to keep the lights turned on and pay for the wine and the hosts and things like that. So even though your participation might be minimal, it's a nice gesture to be able to put something in the collection basket if you can, but it's not required. So you're on the right path, if that's what you're asking me, to try to spread it around a little bit. But even if you didn't and you only gave to the parish in which you're registered, that wouldn't be a problem. That wouldn't be a sin or anything like that, if that's what you're wondering.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You're welcome. And I'm going to say a little prayer that your financial circumstances will become even easier for you. Thank you. Let's go to Agnes now in Chicago. Hi, Agnes.
Hi, Patrick. My question is concerning where was my Jesus wandering after he saw the apostles in the upper room twice? Mm-hmm. And then Peter went fishing, and then Jesus appeared to them at the seashore. Mm-hmm. In between that time, where do you think Jesus was?
Well, I have some thoughts on that. We're not told by the Holy Bible, so we don't have that information by divine revelation. But I think that among the other things that Jesus did was he spent time with his mother, and that he comforted her and gave her great joy to see that he had risen from the dead. And in a way similar to how his time at home with her for 30 years, we know virtually nothing about. We do know that he was under her and St. Joseph's authority in the little town of Nazareth when he was a boy. We see a glimpse of him at the age of 12 when he and his parents went to the temple and he got separated from them. And then we don't see anything about those 30 years spanning from when he was born, then the finding in the temple, and then when he's approximately 30 years old at the wedding at Cana. We see him at the wedding with the Blessed Virgin Mary, and he performs his first public miracle. But for 30 years, we have no specific information. Other than that, he was at home with them. So that leads me to think, from a biblical standpoint, that perhaps a great deal of what Jesus was doing, when we don't see any mention of him or his whereabouts between the resurrection and the ascension, is that he was probably spending time with his mother.
I like that idea.
Kind of fits, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. I like that idea.
Me too. Me too. I mean, of all the people on earth who knew Jesus, the Blessed Virgin Mary knew him by far and away the best. She had the most intimate relationship with Jesus, her son. And to, can you imagine, Agnes, what it would have been like to have Jesus in your home day after day, year after year, for 30 years? If anyone knew Jesus, it was the Blessed Virgin Mary. Pretty amazing.
You bet. You bet. Oh, that must have been quite a thrill for her.
No doubt about it. We'll find out so many more of these things when we get to heaven. But in the meantime, it is interesting to speculate, right?
Right. I want to pop another thing to you. You had 11 children. I have 9. Mm-hmm. And we took our kids camping all over the United States during the summer with our pop-top camper. Mm-hmm. And we never missed Mass, because on Saturday we always made sure that where we were going to set up the camp that night, it was near church. It was never a problem.
Mm-hmm.
People say you go on vacation, you can miss Mass. And I never understood why they could or should.
Yep.
Because there are so many churches, and you get to see the churches throughout the country. They're beautiful.
They are indeed. Well, it sounds like your kids had an idyllic upbringing, camping all the time. That's fun. Thank you, Agnes. Thank you. I'll be right back. Thanks to network sponsor PushPay. PushPay offers parishes a platform for tracking donations and sacraments, overseeing schedules, mobile apps to help manage your administrative load, and much more. Info at relevantradio.com/pushpay. That's relevantradio.com/pushpay.
Taco Tuesday! Taco Tuesday!
Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
Now that's what I call a taco.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149.
Taco!
That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
Taco!
Yeah, Taco Tuesday. So I have an email here from Jose Luis, and he's listening in SoCal, and he wants to know about a gluten-free host. Is that okay for consecration? Well, not exactly. They're technically not gluten-free, and for this reason, in order for the host, the little wafer of bread, for those who are not Catholic, we call that a host in the Catholic Church, that's used at Mass for the consecration so that this little wafer of bread and the chalice of wine becomes, through the miracle of transubstantiation, the very body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus under the appearances of bread and wine. So in the Catholic Church, the valid material, we call it the valid matter for the Holy Eucharist in the case of the bread, it must be unleavened wheat bread. Can't be a peanut butter cookie, can't be a potato chip, it can't be unleavened bread with butter or salt or sugar added to it. All it can be is unleavened wheat bread. That's what's valid for the Holy Eucharist in the Latin Rite of the Catholic Church. So anything that is not wheat flour is not usable. So wheat includes gluten. And I know many people are gluten-free nowadays, whether for real or they just go along with the trend. But for whatever reason, the host must have at least a small amount of gluten in it to be wheat bread. If it's not, if there's no gluten in it, then it's not wheat bread anymore. It's a derivative, but it's no longer wheat. So when you receive Holy Communion at a parish where they offer this option, it's a low-gluten host. So that's the short answer to that. Now, for some people for whom even a small portion of gluten in the host would cause them problems with, say, you know, whatever the illness is that they have that could be affected by gluten, you can receive Holy Communion from the precious blood. And so that's another workaround. And even at our parish, there's some people who have a severe gluten intolerance and they can't receive even the low gluten host, but they can receive the precious blood. So accommodations can be made, but that's the main thing. Yes, low gluten hosts are valid for consecration, but no gluten hosts would not be valid for consecration. Let's go to Joshua now in Albuquerque. Good morning, Joshua.
Good morning, Patrick. I liked your spot on the third episode of Mass of the Ages. Good job.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate that.
I was approached on my way to Mass by three Seventh-day Adventists, and they're just challenging me on the, you know, Sunday obligation. It should be mm-hmm. Saturday and everything. So I gave mm-hmm. them, I was pretty proud of myself. I gave them pretty good answers from the, you know, the church that has the power, the keys and everything. And mm-hmm. the final thing that they came up with was, I'm pretty sure he said Daniel, but it might've been Ezekiel. And I did a cursory search of Daniel, but didn't find it. He said that, there's a verse there that says anybody who changes the Sabbath from Saturday to Sunday is the Antichrist. And I was wondering if you have ever heard of that and what the answer would be to them.
No, I have not heard of that. I would be interested in the specific verse that I could look at, but short of that, yeah. I mean, if you discover something and you want to send it my way, please feel free. But short of that, there is a way to describe or to talk about this in a way that I have found very successful with talking to Seventh-day Adventists. And that's to go to Genesis. If you have a pen handy, you might want to jot it down. Genesis chapter 17. And in this passage, God is speaking to Abram. So his name hasn't been changed yet, or it's about to be changed. And God gives him a commandment that actually predates the Ten Commandments. And beginning in verse 1, you read where he says, "Walk in my presence and be blameless. Between you and me, I will establish my covenant." Verse 7, "I will maintain my covenant with you and your descendants after you throughout the ages as an everlasting pact to be your God and the God of your descendants after you." Verse 9, God said to Abraham, "On your part, you and your descendants after you must keep my covenant throughout the ages. This is my covenant with you and your descendants after you, that you must keep. Every male among you shall be circumcised." And he goes on to describe circumcision. And then in verse 13, he says, "Thus my covenant shall be in your flesh as an everlasting pact. If a male is uncircumcised, that is, if the flesh of his foreskin has not been cut away, such a one shall be cut off from his people, for he has broken my covenant." And so you see in this passage a repetition about this is an everlasting covenant. This must be done all the way until the end of time. Well, you could point out to your Seventh-day Adventist interlocutors that they don't practice circumcision. This is a commandment on par with the Ten Commandments. And Jesus does not say, all right, no more circumcision, everybody. The church changed that. So the church observes this commandment to enjoin circumcision, in this case, upon males. But the church observes this for male and female in the elevated form of baptism. The church had the authority given by Jesus to transfer or to modify the way in which this commandment would be observed. And this is why Seventh-day Adventists no longer circumcise. Because the Catholic Church in the very beginning, during the time of the apostles, it dispensed with circumcision as the way to observe this commandment and substituted it with the higher form, the sacrament of baptism. And Seventh-day Adventists, wittingly or unwittingly, they follow suit. So you can point this out. You can say, look, you yourselves follow a teaching of the Catholic Church that was not given by Jesus. It was given by inspiration of the Holy Spirit to the apostles. And that is that circumcision no longer obtains. But that was the church that made that decision. You can see it in Acts chapter 15, where they were deliberating and debating over this Judaizing tendency, the faction of people who said, in order to be a Christian, you must first be a Jew. You must first be circumcised if you're a man. You must keep kosher. And all those things that were pertinent to the Mosaic ceremonial law, you have to do those things if you want to be a follower of Jesus. Peter received the revelation in Acts chapter 10 regarding the kosher food laws that that was no longer the case. And so the church decided in this council, all right, well, that's done now. We don't have to do those things anymore. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because there's a direct parallel here between this commandment that God gave regarding circumcision and the commandment to keep holy the Sabbath day, the seventh day of the week. So the church likewise has the authority to maintain observance of the commandment, but transfer its observance from Sunday to the first day of the week. I'm sorry, from Saturday, the seventh day of the week, to Sunday, the first day of the week. So there's a direct parallel there that is unanswerable, if you ask me, from Seventh-day Adventists. So if you have a particular verse you want me to look at, shoot it over to me, patrick@relevantradio.com. And I'll be happy to take a look at that. And by the way, there is a book that came out in the last couple of years, and it's by a convert from Seventh-day Adventism. She became a Catholic, and I want to get the exact title. But I believe it's called It's Okay Not to Be a Seventh-day Adventist. And she is now a Catholic. But let me just double-check that I have this title correctly. And I would recommend, if you're dealing with Seventh-day Adventists in any significant way, this would be a book that will help you. So yes, It's Okay to Not Be a Seventh-day Adventist. And it's a book written by, let me give you the author's name, Teresa Beam, B-E-E-M, Teresa Beam. And it's her conversion testimony, but in the process of telling her story, she also takes into account all the various arguments that Seventh-day Adventist folk, her family, and others would use to tell her why she was wrong to become a Catholic, including the whole Sabbath Sunday issue. So that might be something for further study for you. Thanks for the call. Let's go to, let's see, Julia in Chicago. Good morning, Julia.
Good morning, Patrick. My question is, how do I guide my daughter to show her that the Roman Catholic Church is the only church founded by Jesus Christ, instead of, because right now she's 19 and she kind of told me that she's not going to participate in the Catholic Church anymore. So I wanted to know
Did she say why not?
She says that my church is kind of boring and that she doesn't have all the answers and that we are not really true because we don't follow the Bible. And I don't know the other religion, whether it's only Bible, because she has Bible studies supposedly. So I don't know I don't want to force her in, but now she just wants to leave. So I don't know how to.
Okay. So my guess is that she's being coached and influenced in this regard by some Protestant friends. That's my mm-hmm. guess. This is yeah. not uncommon, but there are many remedies for the situation. So she just needs good answers to the erroneous claims that these people are making to her. And there are plenty of them. If you want to give her some books, I would say give her a copy of Surprised by Truth. Do you have a pen handy so you can jot this down?
Yes.
Okay, so Surprised by Truth. and it has 11 testimonies of former Protestants, much like the people she's talking to right now, who became Catholic. And they explain how they overcame their misunderstandings and objections to the Catholic Church. That book has got an amazing pedigree of people just like your daughter who were outward bound away from Jesus and the Catholic Church, thinking that they were going toward Jesus, and they wound up having a profound conversion. So it's got a red cover, and it was originally published in 1994. Now, full disclosure, I edited that book, which you can get a cheapo copy for pennies, a used copy online for pennies. I'm not trying to sell you a book. It is so choice.
If you have the means, I highly recommend picking one up.
That's a good point, Cyrus, as long as you're at it. It is so choice. So that's one book, Surprised by Truth. Give her that book and just say, you know what? It's interesting because there are a bunch of people who made the same decision that you seem to be making now, and here's what happened with them. I would get her a book by Carl Keating called Catholicism and Fundamentalism. And it is a refutation, a very interesting refutation of all the many kind of arguments that she's experiencing right now. It gets into all of the peculiar arguments that are raised against the Catholic Church. That could be very helpful for her. I would recommend the audio sets by Dr. Scott Hahn. Are you familiar with Dr. Scott Hahn?
Not really. I'm not.
Okay. He's a major player when it comes to apologetics with Protestants. He used to be an evangelical Protestant minister. He was a Calvinist. And he was very anti-Catholic. He wound up having a conversion to the Catholic faith in 1986. Man, hard to believe, almost 40 years ago. And the first thing you can do is I would get his conversion testimony, which I actually set this up at my parish in June of 1989 when he was an unknown. Nobody knew who Dr. Scott Hahn was in those days. He didn't have his doctorate in those days. But he gave a really powerful presentation on why he became Catholic. And if you look it up on YouTube, it's called, so put in Scott Hahn, H-A-H-N, Protestant Minister Becomes Catholic.
Okay.
Protestant Minister Becomes Catholic. That's the one you want. And you can tell you have the right one because in the beginning he says, you know, back in those days before my conversion, I did not relish, or maybe it was the priest who said this, I forget which, he says the word relish. I did not relish the idea of becoming a Catholic. But that's about an hour long. Okay. And when that first came out, Julia, I'm not kidding you, it blew the doors off people's minds. They couldn't believe what they were hearing because he gave such a powerful clarion call for why he would abandon evangelicalism and become Catholic. And then, of course, many other audio sets and audio talks that he gave are readily available as well on just about any issue. So I would definitely check those things out. Encourage your daughter to listen to this program.
Yeah, I have, you know, and also the thing that she also has questions about the Eucharist, you know, because he said, oh, no, I received the Eucharist in another, like, no, you can, because it's not how it's supposed to, you know, that the only one that has a true one is the Catholic Church, you know, how the words and everything, you know.
Yeah. These are all things, right? I have to take a break, Julia, forgive me, but these are all things that are answered in these materials that I gave you. So there's really no question that she might have or challenge or disagreement that's not answered. So start with these things, and I'm hopeful that she'll be open and willing to listen to them. And if so, I predict good things for her. Thanks, Julia. I'll be right back. This hour is supported by Notre Dame Federal Credit Union. Join the nation's largest Catholic-oriented credit union and receive $200 when you add a direct deposit. Learn more at NotreDameFCU.com/join. That's NotreDameFCU.com/join.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
Grande.
Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
I think this is my new favorite Taco Tuesday song, Cyrus.
Good to know.
And even better than the other one.
No.
You don't think so?
You can have that opinion, but you're wrong.
This is great. I love Weird. Nobody loves Weird Al more than me, but
I guess because I'm burned out on the other one.
Well, you know what happens, Patrick? I felt the same way, and so I didn't play it a week or two ago, and then I got an email.
You got hammered for it?
I did get hammered for it, and one of them, like, kind of hurt a little. She's Ooh. Like, it was my daughter's, I don't remember, like, 7th birthday, and we waited all show for that song. I guess you're not going to play it.
You're a bad man,
I know,
Cyrus.
I felt bad. So
you're bad.
That's why I opened the show with it today. So if you're just tuning in now and you didn't get to hear your Taco Tuesday song, it's the very first break in the first hour. It'll be on the podcast very soon. Yeah.
Well, I love our listeners. I know you do too. And there's no doubt but that they listen very carefully. And that's an example of that. They listen and they know when there's something missing. I got a note this morning from a very nice lady who wanted me to make, she wanted to make sure I understood that when I talked about the, what was it I was talking about? Oh, the tie a yellow ribbon around the old oak tree yesterday and the hostage crisis.
Oh, yeah.
She said, you neglected to talk about the role Canada played in all this. Well, I didn't neglect to do it. There were a million things I could have brought up about the hostage crisis. I gave a quick synopsis. So, no, it wasn't a matter of neglect, but she wanted to make sure that I knew that Canada had a role to play, and a very important role, too. In fact, there's a movie called Argo. I don't have that lady's email in front of me, so I don't remember her name, but if she's listening, she's in Canada. Argo. What's that actor's name again, Cyrus?
Ben something. Ben.
Yeah, Ben Affleck.
There it is.
Okay. And he and, you know, the other actors portray the Canadian, they're in the Canadian embassy in Tehran when this all goes down. And it's a thrilling movie, and it really does help people understand more the role of those Canadian folk in helping our hostages get free. I know it's ancient history for most people. If they're young enough, they don't remember any of it, but that's what I mean. Our listeners listen very carefully. And so she wanted me to make sure that she thought I neglected that detail. So happy to mention it. Let's go to Jade in Cape Coral. I almost said Cape Canaveral, but Cape Coral, Florida. Good morning, Jade.
Good morning. How are you?
I am well, thank you.
Thank you for taking my call. So my question is, I'm still just really confused on the whole timeline as far as the Roman Catholic Church being the only one and true church of our God and Jesus, our Savior. Mm-hmm. Because, like, St. Peter, when he was alive, we don't know exactly how he did everything other than what the apostles say. And then when you read history books, you know, he's mentioned in lots of history books, not just Roman Catholic, but it was like years later before the Roman Catholics began being called the Roman Catholics.
There's a reason
for that.
At
the very beginning, weren't they part of the people that persecuted Jesus?
Yeah. So there's a reason for that, Jade, and maybe this will be helpful in a chronological sense here. So the term Roman Catholics, I kind of flinch when I hear Catholics using that term. I'm not talking about you. You know, the Roman Catholic parish, blah, blah, blah. Or, you know, the Roman Catholic Church, this, and that, and the other. I understand why people do that, because it's sort of a way to pull yourself up to your full height and proudly express that you're a Catholic. But this is something that was begun using the phrase Roman Catholic Church. It was begun in the Church of England after the time of the Protestant Reformation, from, you know, beginning with King Henry VIII and then feeding into the reign of Queen Elizabeth I, it was a polemical term that was intended to try to flatten the Catholic Church down to the lowest common denominator. And the belief behind it was where you've got the Eastern Catholic Church, aka what we would call the Eastern Orthodox Churches, you've got the Roman Catholic Church, you've got the Anglican or Anglo-Catholic Church, and others besides. The theory was that the so-called Roman Catholic Church is just one flavor. It's one little subset within what they imagined to be the Catholic Church in a broader sense, in an historical sense. And that's utterly untrue, utterly untrue. I mentioned earlier St. John Henry Newman as an example. He used to hold a similar sort of view, and he wanted to disprove the Catholic Church's claim to being that original church, the Catholic Church in the early church. The early church did not use the phrase the Roman Catholic Church. It was a polemical way of trying to box the Catholic Church into a little compartment and make it sort of like, you know, you're just on par with those Anglo-Catholics or those Orthodox Catholics or those various other Catholics. So Newman, when he began to really do the study, and he was fluent and literate, I should say, in patristic Greek and Latin, etc. So he realized, wait a minute, these early Christians were not Eastern Orthodox. They certainly weren't like Anglican Catholics, the so-called Via Media, Middle Way. They were Catholic in the sense of the word. And so he too sort of fought against this use of the phrase Roman Catholic, because he understood it was a way of trying to diminish the reality of the Catholic Church. There really is just the Catholic Church. And nowadays, people will say the Roman Catholic Church because I think they think that they're somehow making it more majestic or more. The church is one holy, Catholic, and apostolic. There is a Roman rite within the church. Also, we call it the Latin rite within the church. There's a Byzantine rite, a Maronite rite, Mozarabic rite, various other rites within the church. But the Catholic Church as such globally is just the Catholic Church. So for that reason, I don't mean to belabor the point, Jade, but it is true that it was late in church history that the phrase Roman Catholic Church began to come into view, but that was being used by the enemies of the Catholic Church for the reasons I just mentioned. But if you go into the early church, what you see is the use of the Catholic Church as such, and that's what we're talking about, and that's what the so-called Roman Catholic Church is, even though people don't realize that that term Roman Catholic Church is redundant and superfluous. So there's a long answer to your short question, but that's an important perspective on the chronology of that term and how we can understand it better.
Yes, thank you. That helps me a lot. So what year, if we're talking about chronology, what year then would you say the Catholic Church was actually formed? After the Reformation? Because before that, weren't they just called Christ followers? Or...
Well, no. I think I understand your question. Correct me if I don't. But the Catholic Church was established by Jesus Christ in Jerusalem when he, first of all, he died on the cross, and the blood and the water that flowed from the side of his body after his death, the church fathers and others look at that as sort of the equivalent in a metaphorical sense of the blood and water, the amniotic fluid that comes from the mother when the baby is to be born. And the church was, you might say, formally inaugurated on the day of Pentecost, but that's when the Catholic Church started. And even by the very beginning of the second century, so a man who knew the apostles, at least a couple of them, his name was St. Ignatius of Antioch, and he was the bishop of that city of Antioch where Peter had been bishop before for a time. And he's on his way to Rome to be martyred, and he wrote a series of letters, seven letters or epistles, six to the various churches that he met along the way, and one that he wrote to, his name is blanking in my mind, it'll come to me. It's one of those names, if I hadn't had to answer your question, I could have told you right off the top. But in any case, in those letters, he's using the word Catholic Church, or the words. And he refers to where the bishop is, there is the Eucharist, and there is the Catholic Church. And he didn't feel the need to explain what he meant, which is evidence that people already were using the term Catholic Church. And in the contemporary writings of the day and those shortly thereafter, there's nobody who says, the what church? The Catholic Church, what's that? So they were already referring to themselves as Catholics by the end of the first century. And this is a man who learned the gospel directly from the Apostle John. And you see, from that time forward, the church referred to and referring to itself as the Catholic Church, with the same doctrines and all of the external characteristics of the church, which, by the way, as Jesus said in the Gospels, the church, the kingdom of heaven, is like a mustard seed. that grows from a little tiny speck into a huge, almost the size of a tree kind of plant. And that's the nature of the Church Christ established. It looks different in its infancy than it does now, but it's the same church, the same organism.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can I ask you one more question?
Sure.
So, do you believe, or somebody asked you, will Christians that have faith in Jesus that are not Catholics, for whatever reason, you know, there's a million reasons, but for whatever reason, will they also get to be with Jesus, get to be, go to heaven, to be with the Lord for eternity, or only Catholic believers?
Well, there's an answer to that question that I'll give you. I'll begin, though, by quoting a church father, St. Cyprian of Carthage, who was martyred, I believe, in the year 250. I'd have to double-check that, but I believe it was about the year 250. So he was very close in time to Jesus and the apostles. And he has a famous line that he taught, and this was consistent with what the church taught, and that is, you can't have God as your father if you refuse to have the church as your mother. And he was speaking about heretics and those who would refuse to be Catholic. He says, in essence, he's saying, no, you can't be saved if you knowingly, willingly reject Jesus and the church that he established. And so that's a reflection of the church's age-old teaching, and that is that there is no salvation outside the Catholic Church. Now, that may seem shocking to you, and I could understand why, but that has always been the teaching of the Catholic Church. But there's a nuance here, and that is, for those who recognize that the Catholic Church is the church that Christ established and refuse to enter into it, no, they cannot be saved. But if through no fault of their own, or if their guilt or their culpability for not knowing is diminished, the church says that God, of course, can grant salvation to anyone whom he wishes, and he can grant sanctifying grace to anybody because he's God, he's sovereign. So we don't say, I mean, the Catholic Church doesn't say that in a way that hasn't been revealed to us, that God doesn't save some people who are not members of the visible Catholic Church in this life. But it's much more difficult for somebody who does not have access to the sacrament. So, for example, Jesus says, unless you are baptized of water and the Holy Spirit, you cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. I know many Protestants are baptized. Or he says, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you will not have life within you. That gets to the question of the Eucharist. So ultimately, to answer your question, we would have to say, is this person, the Protestant person you have in mind, or whoever, is he or she responsible for knowing that the Catholic Church is true and saying, no, I'm not going to do that? Or is it possible through circumstances or upbringing or some other reason that he or she genuinely doesn't realize that, doesn't know? Well, then the Catholic Church says it is possible for salvation, that's true, but only in a way that's known to God, because he hasn't revealed that to us. Jesus said you have to be baptized, you have to receive the Eucharist if it's possible, and so on. But we have people like the good thief on the cross who did neither of those things, and we know he was saved.
Right, right, right. Okay. All right. I will do more research so that I know it when I try to talk to people. But the other thing that people say to me all the time is that now, with the Pope allowing same-sex marriages and everything that's in the social media right now, allowing it to come into the church, they take a very strong stance on how ungodly that is.
Well, let's pause there for a moment. And that may be another good area for you to research. There's no question that these are difficult times for the church, and there's a lot of ambiguity and all that. But to be fair, the Pope definitely has not allowed same-sex marriage into the church. It's a misreading of the things that he has said. And with this issue of the blessing of same-sex couples, I will readily acknowledge that this has created a real problem pastorally for the church, because it gives an impression that actually is not borne out by the document itself. Fiducia supplicans is the document. It means with supplicating faith. It's the first few words of this document, this declaration. So to be fair, no, the Catholic Church in no way has revised its teaching on marriage. It'd be impossible for it to do so because it teaches the truth and the truth can't change. But people's understanding of what was meant by what was said are really where the problem lies. Unfortunately, I'm out of time now, Jade, so I'll have to leave it at that. But if you were to read that document, Fiducia Supplicans, you'll find that the first half of it is a consistent reiteration of the church's teaching that marriage is between one man and one woman, and two men cannot get married, two women cannot get married. It's really clear. But the way it was worded toward the end, some people are getting the misimpression. So if you want to call another time and talk about that, I'd be happy to do so. But I'm out of time for the moment. Thank you. And my apologies to everybody who was holding. Call me tomorrow. We'll get you on the air with your comment or question. And in the meantime, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.
Adios, amigos.